Okay, so we're going to wrap up our discussion of the Fast Fourier Transform today, and I'm going to work from these this set of notes today. But I'd also want you to read through the textbook, of course, which goes into this in a little more detail. I noticed I've still gotten very few homeworks turned, computer assignments turned in. So I'm hoping I'm not going to get an avalanche the last week of the semester. So I'm really, I think at this point, I don't know what to say other than the fact that you aren't keeping up on those programming assignments means you're out of sequence with the lectures, and that's not good. But I know some of you are busy with senior design and other things like that. But at some point, we're going to be past the point of no return on this course in terms of getting the homework assignments in. So we've got to keep up. We also have an exam next week, last lecture of the three lectures will be the exam. It will cover whatever chapters were listed in the syllabus. So I will be grading homework for that exam as well. So turn in your homework notebooks. Okay, so any questions or issues? Okay, so what we want to do today in this first lecture is to talk about the fast Fourier transform. So last class, we introduced the concept of Fourier transform. And if I have a signal x of n, how do I compute the Fourier transform? How do I compute the discrete Fourier transform? No clue, right? What class are we in? DSP? Sum of what? So we're going to take the sum from n equals 0 to n minus 1 of x of n e to the minus j 2 pi k n over xn. So we're summing over the signal, and we're computing the frequency samples. Where are these samples located in the frequency domain? Times.
Okay.
Good. So we're going to have samples at zero, fs over n, 2fs over n, and so on. K, fs over n. So there's a few things we want to concern ourselves with. One is to reduce the number of multiply adds. And what's the reason for this? Well, one of the big reasons is that this algorithm is of complexity O of n squared. But the second issue, which we won't really discuss much in this course, I'll maybe allude to this at the end of the lecture, is how to compute in fixed point. Why does this interest us? Right. This is going to cost us less. It's going to require less power and less cost. Because floating point chips are more expensive than fixed point chips. And for small, for compact consumer grade applications, it may make sense to do a fixed point implementation. What is the what are the challenges in doing this in fixed point? What? Right. What the challenge with fixed point, of course, is that you're going to have a, you have a fixed range essentially. If you multiply two 4-bit numbers, what does this give you? What's the maximum value this can give you? How many bits do you need to represent the result? How many bits? 8 bits, right? In this computation, is X of N range limited? In a real application, is X of N range limited? What's the range of X of N? For 16-bit data, we could say that X of N is range limited, right? If we're doing this in floating point, like if you're doing this in MATLAB, you might say, well, X of N has a range of 0 to 1, plus positive and negative. But if we're doing this in fixed point, you would say, well, X of N might have a range of 16 bits. What about the e to the jx term? Right. The magnitude of e to the jx is equal to 1. So that has very nice properties, that it's essentially a vector whose magnitude is always 1. So this is actually a fairly easy calculation to scale, because we have fixed point ranges on both of the operands. We still have to worry about summing them together. But generally speaking, fixed point performance is good. And you can find applications where FFTs are done in very limited amounts of arithmetic so that they can run very fast. So we're not going to talk too much about this today, but what we want to focus on is this problem. So let's talk about how we make the FFT run quickly. So we have our definition of the DFT, and we said that we're going to use this notation W sub capital N superscript KN to denote this e to the JX term. And the reason that we're going to do that is that we want to make use of some of the periodic or periodicity of this signal. So W sub n is essentially dividing the unit circle into n sections. And when we raise this to the kn power, we have our term which appears in the equation here. So these are just samples on the unit circle. So if, for example, we looked at n equals 4, and we looked at all possible values of k and n, we will find out that there's only 4 unique values for this function. Even though there's 16 different combinations of k and n, there's only 4 unique values. And for example, if we take W sub 4 raised to the 3 and 2 powers, we can show that this is just minus 1. So these functions have two important symmetry properties which we'll make use of when we do derive the expressions for the FFT. That there's symmetry about the imaginary axis. So a point here can be related to a point here just by flipping the sign. And there's periodicity. This is a function that's periodic in capital N. So we're going to exploit this symmetry to make the FFT run faster. But let's first talk a little bit more about what the basic complexity is. So we talked last time about the fact that we could write the e to the jx term as cosine plus j sine and expand this inner term inside the summation. And we observe that this is going to essentially require a multiply here, a multiply here, and we're also going to have to track the sine. So we've written this in terms of the real part and the imaginary part for the sample x of k. The real part comes from xn cosine, and the imaginary part comes from the sine terms. And this is done assuming that x of n, the signal, could be complex. Obviously, if the signal is real, we only have to worry about the cosine term here and the sine term here. We don't have to worry about these cross terms. But if the signal is imaginary, we have to worry about the cross terms. So if x of n is complex, this requires 2n squared evaluations of trig functions. It requires 4n squared real multiplications. And it requires 4 times n times n minus 1 real additions, roughly 4n squared real additions also. And then there's some miscellaneous indexing and bookkeeping and such that we're going to have to do. So because we have these n squared terms here, we in general say that the computational complexity of this operation is O of n squared. And that implies that the total number of computations required is proportional to the length of the input, where the length of the input is n squared. So why is this, why does this concern us, this kind of complexity?
Output vector will be longer than your input vector? Is
it? No. Now, if you put endpoint, if you put endpoints of a signal in, you get endpoints of the transform out.
But it says it's not linearly proportional to the length of the input.
It's not linearly proportional, right?
If you have a, if the input goes from 256 to 512, you get a really, really big jump.
Instead of doubling, it quadruples, right? And it grows exponentially pretty quickly. So, a 1,000 point FFT would give us 1 million computations. And in the early days of DSP, that was unthinkable, that kind of complexity. Even today, if we talk about a audio signal sampled at 44,000 hertz, doing an FFT on that can be very computationally complex. But fortunately, because this function is periodic, and because this is O of n squared, we can actually use a divide and conquer approach. And what I'd like you to take away from today's lecture on this topic is not so much the details of an FFT, but the general strategy that we use to deal with the computational complexity. I don't know if you're like me, but my mail thing here is bothering me. We're having networking problems. Let me kill that thing. That should be better. So what we can do is we can use a divide and conquer approach. So let's look at the case when n, the length of the signal, can be factored into a product of two integers, L and M. And we'll actually oftentimes, in the book, we'll actually look at the special case of L equals 2. But here we did it in a little more general way. So we can look at values of L and values of M. And we can look at all of the terms required to compute. For example, when L is 0 and N is 0, we need to compute X of 0. And we can sort of go through element by element and look at what computations are required. And what we find out when we do that is that there are some opportunities to reuse computations. So we can actually factor this summation. This is one of the nice things about summations. Because this summation is just a sum, and you can interchange the order in which you sum things, we can factor this summation into, do it in a different order so that we can group similar things together. So we can actually rewrite this summation as two summations, a summation over M followed by a summation over L. And we can observe in doing that, and this is really the key step here, that the inner term, this is just an M point discrete Fourier transform. And the outer term represents an L-point discrete Fourier transform. So this computation which is over n points. If n is factorable into L times m, we can actually write this as the combination of an m point DFT and then followed by an L point DFT of those results. Right? So, for example, we could split the signal by a factor of 2. And we could say, well, let's do the n over 2 DFT first, and then we'll do a 2-point DFT of those results. So this refactoring of the computation into essentially a double summation, first over m and first over l, this turns out to give us a fairly big win in terms of the DFT computations. And the reason that is comes back to this issue of the complexity being O of n squared. So we can look at, for example, the case of n equals 1,000. And the normal complexity at O of n squared is going to be 10 to the 6th, 1,000 squared. This is 10 to the 3, so 10 to the 3 squared is 10 to the 6th. But if we factor that into a 500-point DFT followed by a 2-point DFT, we essentially do these 500 terms first, and then we do a 2-point DFT on those, the output of that. The complexity now becomes O of m squared plus O of l squared. Well, O of L squared is in the noise because it's only 2. O of M squared, which is 500, is going to give us 5 times 10 to the 5th. So by splitting this into, rather than doing one 1,000-point FFT, by doing two 500-point FFTs, we cut in half the number of computations. And the only reason that works is because the complexity is O of n squared. If the complexity was O of n, this wouldn't work. But because the complexity is of O of n squared, there's a benefit to doing this as a sequence of two FFTs. So we can actually write this a little more explicitly, that the divide and conquer approach takes n times m plus l plus 1 complex multiplications and n times m plus l minus 2 additions. So the complexity is reduced from O of n squared to something less than O of n squared. We're going to get at least a factor of 2 out of this efficiency by simply going from a 1,000-point FFT to two 500-point FFTs. Well, let's think about that. So here we have a diagram that depicts how we would compute a 15-point DFT. We could do a 15-point DFT as a product of a 5-point DFT followed by a 3-point DFT. So here we have the data coming in. Here we do a 5-point DFT, and then that's followed by a 3-point DFT. And then we get our outputs. So if n is what's called a highly composite number, which means that it can be factored into a product of small prime numbers, this is advantageous because then we can decompose an FFT into lots of small FFTs. So for example, if n is 210, we can decompose this into 2 times 3 times 5 times 7. Now, what's the advantage of that versus doing one large 210-point FFT?
You send different pieces to different cores in the...
No, we haven't talked about parallelism yet. Just in terms of the number of operations required. What's the advantage of doing this versus doing this? What's the complexity of this 2-point FFT? Remember, it's O of n squared, so it's relatively small, 4. This is 9. This is 25. This is 49. All of those summed together are still much less than 210 squared. So highly composite numbers are a good thing because we can break those numbers up into very small FFTs and do lots of small FFTs. What happens if n is prime?
You can't break it down at all.
We're screwed, right? So what's a way around that based on something we discussed last week?
Zero padding.
So no problem. N is prime, we just zero pad it. So one of the things I always like to describe in DSP is as engineers, we're very opportunistic. So if splitting an FFT in half gives us an advantage, doing more of the same should work even better, right? So whenever you find out something works well, we do more of it until it hurts. So what's the most advantageous value of n that would allow us to split it into really, really small FFTs? We talked about this concept of highly composite. What's in the limit? What is one of the most highly composite numbers you can have?
Smallest prime is 2, so a multiple of something 2 raised to some number.
Something that's a power of 2 is something we can decompose into lots of 2-point transforms. So fast Fourier transforms are simply DFTs constrained to where n is a value, which is a power of 2. Powers of 2 meaning things like 2, 4, 8, 16, and so forth. If for some reason our frame size is not a power of 2, our window duration is 240 samples for some reason, we just zero pad it out to the next highest power of 2, 256, and then we do an FFT. That's faster than trying to do a DFT of 240 points. Much, much faster. So the core computational element in an FFT is often what we call a radix 2 transform, which is a transform based on splitting the signal in a factor of 2. We can also split the signal into a factor of 4 or higher depending on the number. So if we have a 16-point FFT, we could split it into 2 to the 4, so we could split it into 4 2-point FFTs, or we could actually do 2 4-point FFTs. So we've got some flexibility with how we arrange these things. We're going to now look at the core computation, which is a radix 2. And this is often what we call decimation in time, because we're going to take the signal and we're going to split it into 2 signals. We're going to take every other sample and call that F1 of n, and then those are the even numbered samples, 0, 2, 4, 6, 8. And then we're going to take every other sample, the odd number samples, and call that F2 of n. This is referred to as a decimation in time approach. And if we do this, we can take our definition for the DFT and we can split it into 2 summations, one over the even sample values and one over the odd sample values. And we can write this then as a sum over m of the even sample values plus a sum over n of the odd sample values. Again, the beauty of summations are we can do them in whatever order we want. So we're just reordering the way we do things. But now we observe that anything, there's sort of a modulo 2 situation here, that w raised to the second power is equal to w for n over 2. And if we're doing an n-point subdivision of the unit circle, and we raise that to a second power, that's exactly equal to taking the unit circle and dividing it by n over 2. So therefore, we can write this computation as a sum of what amounts to 2 n over 2 point DFTs. So F1 of k and F2 of k, that's just referring to these two terms here, are n over 2 point DFTs, but then we have to do a little bit of work to combine them. We have to multiply by an e to the jx function. That comes by factoring out this wnk raised to the first power here. So we can do 2 n over 2 point DFTs, one of the even numbered samples, one of the odd number samples, and then we can combine them. And we can, of course, repeat this process. If these n over 2 point FFTs, if we start with 256, these n over 2 point FFTs are going to be 128 point FFTs. Well, we can take those 128 point FFTs and write them as 264 point FFTs. And we can take the 64 point FFTs and we can write them as 32 point FFTs. So we can continue this process all the way down until the fact that we only have 2 point FFTs. So in the limit, this gives us a complexity of O of n log n. We don't completely become O of n, because we're going to have a series of these FFTs, but we get a complexity of O of n log n. And again, because our original complexity was O of n squared, O of n log n grows much more slowly than O of n squared. And therefore, this is a very big win for us. And the FFT is a great, great example of the power of DSP. Because remember, we're getting the exact same result as a DFT. This is not an approximation. This is an exact result. It gives you identical values. It just gives them to you faster. What's the only price we pay for doing this? What allowed us to achieve this level of efficiency? What assumption or what constraint did we make that we did not have to make for the DFT that allowed us to achieve this level of efficiency? You guys look lost tonight. What's going on? All your other coursework got you overloaded? You really look lost tonight. All right, let's go back. Let's do this all over again. Are there any constraints on this? This is a DFT, right? signal in, frequency samples out. Are there any constraints on N? No. N could be even, it could be odd, it could be prime, we don't care. Are there any constraints on this? N has to be a power of 2. So the only price we pay is that we require N to be a power of 2. In return for that, we get a significant reduction in computing complexity. This was one of the first major DSP results. This enabled the space program, for example, in the 1960s, because all of a sudden, things that could not be computed on existing computers were able to be computed. Computations went from taking days or weeks or months to taking seconds. The FFT is still used today in almost every device that does something with frequency, like your MP3 players and things like that, because it's so efficient. FFTs are this concept of decimation in time, and there's an analogous version called decimation in frequency. These concepts have been applied to many, many different fields, even fields like genetics, decoding DNA and all that kind of stuff. So this is a very, very common trick for speeding up computation. And that's why I still like to talk about this. FFT itself is pretty much a mature technology. You can pick up FFT routines for almost any computing environment that you need. And MATLAB has all algorithms you could ever want programmed. Even in the DSP world, most of the vendors will supply you with very tightly coded DSP libraries. So the radix 2 involves factoring the FFT into a series of two-point FFTs. The radix 4, which is actually slightly more efficient, involves factoring the computation into a series of four-point FFTs. So we often depict this using a diagram that looks something like this or something like this, or sometimes people use what are called butterfly diagrams, which look something like that. What we're talking about really is to just do the following. So here we have a signal. This is an 8-point signal. And we want to make sure that when we're done with this computation, we end up with the signal in the right order. So there's a little bit of a trick to this, that if you start with the input signal in order, the output signal comes out slightly out of order and you have to reorganize it. Or if you shuffle the input signal first, then the output signal will come in the right order. So in this case, we're going to put X0 and X4 here, X2 and X6 here, X1, X5 here, and X3, X7 here. We do 4 2-point DFTs. Then we take those outputs and we combine them using a 2-point DFT. And then we take those and combine them again using a 2-point DFT. But now we're going to have, here we're combining these two outputs and these two outputs, and here we're going to combine the four outputs from here. So we're essentially, we alternate between doing the 2-point DFT and then combining the outputs and then doing another 2-point DFT. And that's what we try to depict here. The net result of this is that you get this O of N log N complexity. This is not unlike if you're familiar with the concept of binary trees. This is also sort of like the way we break search down into an efficient search using a binary tree. we like to draw this computation using what historically were called butterfly diagrams. And this is sort of a signal flow graph version of the computation. So here we have, again, the 8-point inputs. And this is a signal flow graph of what we have to do to such that we compute the output properly. So we're doing the DFTs here, and then we're combining the outputs. In the early days of computing, people actually tried to build computers that implemented these signal flow graphs in hardware so that we had sort of chips or silicon that did these FFTs very, very fast. You can, in fact, with things like FPGAs, implement these signal flow graphs directly as well and make use of the parallel processing and parallel data paths that are available in FPGAs. We have multi-core DSPs where you can do each one of these on a different core. There's lots of different ways this can be further and sped up using specialized hardware. But these algorithms are so efficient now, and processors have gotten so fast that even if you do this on a single processor, single-core processor, you can usually do this in a very reasonable amount of time. Now, there's some interesting extensions of this concept of splitting the signal into two signals. We can actually take two signals and mix them together to compute the FFT of those two signals simultaneously. And we can, again, get the same kind of speed up, this factor of, this O of N squared allows us to speed up this thing. So where would we use this? Well, one of the homework assignments involves computing an FFT every frame. You read a frame of data, you compute an FFT, you read a frame of data, you compute an FFT. So in a streaming application like that, you can take two adjacent frames and compute the FFT of both of them simultaneously. So you can essentially cut your computation time in half, in addition to the speed up that you get for the FFT. So here we're taking the signals and we're setting them up in a complex, we're forming a complex signal. We then go through and do the FFT of that complex signal, and then we have to simply do a little bit of reassembly from the results to get back the FFT for X1 and X2. So we combine the signals into one complex signal, we do the FFT, and then we split the FFT apart to get the FFTs for the individual signals. And again, this process will give us at least a speed up of a factor of 2 over doing FFTs independently on each one of those signals. Yeah.
This only works for 2, though. You can't take that beyond 3 or 4.
You need a power of 2. You need a multiple of 2.
You could do 4 at once.
I don't think you could do 4 at once this way, but I think you could do 4. You could do something similar in a higher dimensional space. So I think if you took the 4 and you did, you allocated, essentially 4 dimensions like A, B, C, D, you might be able to do 4. I think you could derive an algorithm, but no one's ever done that. I mean, this is mainly used in the context of sequential processing where you're going to be doing lots of FFTs and you can just group adjacent frames. Now, there's a couple other things we can exploit about FFTs. If we know the signal is real, we don't have to do all the complex. We don't have to do as many of the complex calculations. Further, you know that the spectrum is periodic, right? When we do an endpoint FFT, we get a spectrum which is periodic. And we know that it's the magnitude spectrum, for example, the spectrum from 0 to FS over 2 is equal to the spectrum from FS over 2 to FS. So we actually, when we have a real signal, which gives us a, and we want to derive the magnitude spectrum, we only need to compute half of the transform, because the other half is the same. So we can make use of, we can do something very similar to what we did with two signals. When the signal is real, we can essentially cram a the real signals into a single FFT and get the same kind of computational speed up. I think the other thing that we can note, we talked a little bit about computational, about precision, and the we can actually show that the signal-to-noise ratio in dB for the FFT is linearly related to the number of bits that are used. And this is a little bit of a derivation that kind of walks you through that. The FFTs are very robust to fixed-point arithmetic, and you would be surprised that even with as little as 4 bits of computation, you can actually get useful information out of an FFT. And in the early days of very low-cost hardware, hardware that did not have a lot of computational power, we could actually do very low-order FFTs and get useful information. I need to fix a couple links on here. We've been having website trouble this afternoon and networking trouble. But I'll point you to a couple pages, one which compares a lot of different FFT algorithms. There's a website known as FFTW that's been for years now collecting all sorts of information and code on FFTs, and just about any FFT algorithm you could ever want is included in this website, and they've done a lot of benchmarks and a lot of back-to-back implementations across a lot of different processors and things. So this is a fairly well-known site that has aggregated a lot of information about FFTs. MATLAB also has all this stuff built into it, so you have access through MATLAB to most of the well-known FFT algorithms. So the main message here is FFT gives you the exact same result as the DFT. It's just a fast way of computing it when your order n is a power of 2. If your order is not a power of 2, just zero stuff up to the next order power of 2, and then you're good to go. Okay, so let's take our first break, and then we will start talking about filter design.